Battle Wallace Super Comic. Battle Wallace Super Comic. Battle Wallace Super Comic. Battle Wallace.
Welcome to Super Comic Battle Wars, Season 1, Volume 1, Episode 4, The Battle of June 2017, Part 6. Now we're just going to keep like making these longer and longer.
Yeah, we're sticking with that.
Yeah. So this is an exciting episode because we are kind of like, I don't say we're globetrotting because we're not really going that far, but we got all of our... Got a couple countries covered today in this episode, but first, I'm Kyle Welch, your host, and I am in upstate New York in America, where here we are making things great again, so it's going well. It's going well for us here. And my regular co-host?
My name is Matt Loon, and I'm from Warwickshire in England. Making England pretty much as good as it ever has been. It's going down in a little bit, but you know,
it's kind of a shit show there too, right?
Yeah. I don't want to put too fine a point on it, but you know, you're right.
And then very excited this week, our third chair, we're joined by the always amazing creator, probably in my top five, maybe not more, artists. We are joined by creator Riley Rossmo from the Great White North, right?
Yeah. Hey, how you doing? Our Prime Minister is making Canada handsome again.
Definitely handsome.
Mm.
Yeah.
Better so looking than our leaders.
A little bit.
Yeah, he's got a strong handshake, man.
Strong handshake.
Yeah.
So if this is the first time listening to the show, or the last time, who knows, the premise of the show is that...
go out on a high.
Get out now. Each of us come to the episode with our five favorite books of the month we are covering. So obviously you're listening just in July, but we are covering June because how could we record the podcast in the same month? That'd be crazy. But, so we're taking our five favorite books, we're introducing them to each other, talking about them, and then, after we do that, we're gonna take all 15 books and try and create the most definitive, undisputed list of best comics ever of that month, so this month, June 2017. So, I guess we'll get started. I don't wanna put Riley on the spot, so I'll start this month, and we never keep track of who actually starts anyway, so
no, I forgot.
My contender number five for book of June 2017 is Shirtless Bear Fighter from Image Comics, and I'm gonna fuck up these names, but it's Jody Layup, Sebastian Gurnier, and art by Nil Vendrell. I think every single one of those names is tough. So Shirtless Bear Fighter, number one. Going into it, I kind of expected it. I mean, I obviously expected it to be kind of goofy and fun. But what's that Ryan Ottoli one that just came out recently? Is it Grizzly?
Grizzly Shark.
Reading this like in the beginning, I kind of expected that, and it was like not hooking me at all. Like, it was very similar, and I thought it was going to be, like, over the top and not really, like, I don't know, like, just over the top and nothing else to it. But as it went, it surprised me. So, obviously, it is just a guy, a shirtless bear fighter. This buff guy lives in the woods, punches bears, is a dick hanging out, walking around. But what I enjoyed most about it was, like, it was completely over the top. He lives in a house made of bears. He flies a plane made of bears. Like, that. But then also to have characters, there's like a assistant FBI agent who like just continually calls out this nonsense and like no one addresses it. I thought it was like really good and worked really well with the jokes, and even more so, like I enjoyed that they just weren't bears. Like there was some sort of story to them, so it wasn't like him just going around punching bears. Where like Grizzly Shark was fun, but it was like kind of just there was a Grizzly Shark and like it was killing people, and there was very limited plot to it. Like that was the plot. There was no like story to it. So this had story. It was over the top. I thought the art was pretty great. Good mix of like cartoony and pretty hard action. And then again, there's a big fucking plane with a dead bear on it. Like I thought it was a lot of fun, and I thought it was going to be a different type of fun, but I think I got more out of it than I thought I was going to, and I really enjoyed it. Because like the first four pages, I thought, meh, this is going to be all right. And then I think it really turned around as we got more into it. And everyone else read this one, right? I think.
Yeah, yeah. I read it. I read it for this episode because I know that you picked it, and I felt the same. Like I think I didn't pick it up at the time because I kind of, by looking at the cover, I knew what it, like what, I thought I knew what kind of issue it was. So I was like, well, okay, well, that, you know what you're getting with it. And I kind of thought, oh, I will pick it up and I'll read it at some point, but I just never got around to it. But then because of the show, I picked it up and read it. And, I did, there's more, you're right, there is like a bit more to it than that. Like it is a bit more, it's funnier than I thought it was going to be. It's kind of, it's self-aware in a kind of way, which is quite good. And I just, there's some like kind of funny moments in it that I thought were kind of good standout bits. And I can see why you picked it. It's definitely it's better than I was expecting a book called Shirtless Bear Fighter to be anyway, so it was good.
Yeah, I agree. It was silly, but it had more content in it than I thought it would have.
Yeah, I thought some of the, I don't know, it was, maybe it's my sense of humor, but like something like even as like silly as like they show up the house and he's like, I told you never to come to my house, to my bear house, like just calling out. And again, like,
yeah,
the kind of the rookie FBI agent continually like asking about it and never getting answers. But I don't know, it definitely like didn't, I made it my number five. And this was a tough month. This was on and off the list a lot, but when I went back and reread it, I actually kind of liked it more. So, it's not going to change the world, but it was a lot of fun. And, like,
I liked it.
If anything, at this point, I've made my case that I enjoy fun books above many others. I'll give them that. So, That was my contender number five. You want to do Matt?
Me, I went for my number five was Winnebago Graveyard number one, which is Steve Niles doing the scripts, Alison Sampson art and design, and covers colors by Stephanie Petro and letters by Aditya Bidikar. I picked this up because I love Alison Sampson. She's fantastic artist. Like she did a graphic novel last year or the year before, I can't remember now, that was kind of, I just picked up on a whim.
Genesis?
What was that? I can't remember the name of it. Did you say the name of it then, Riley?
I think it was called Genesis.
Yeah, that was it. Something like that. And that was, yeah, kind of mind-bending kind of dream sequences, and just the kind of, she's got this real way of warping the landscape and kind of making you feel quite claustrophobic when you're reading it, and kind of twisting your experience through her kind of like weird lens, and so it kind of made perfect sense for her to write a weird horror book, to do the art on a weird horror book. And so Steve Niles has produced this kind of book that's all about ritual sacrifices in the woods, and kind of like being alone, like kind of being alone in America, like out in the backwoods, and there's graphic horror to it, and there's like a road, like a dodgy roadside carnival, and kind of all the horror that you'd expect from that kind of setup. There's like a small family, like a mum, dad and kid, and it's just their experience through this weird carnival, and then, you know, as things start to slowly go wrong. And it's kind of, it reminded me of like an early X-Files episode where it's just, you know, you're kind of, you're dragged into this kind of weird little snapshot of this kind of twisted world. But really, like, Alison Sampson, like, just knocks it out of the park. Like, every page is really tense, even when there's not much going on. And, like, Steve Niles kind of rightly leaves her to tell a lot of the story, because I think he, you know, he can tell that she can paint a really good picture. And I think there's a couple of moments where, like, there's just, like, an ugliness to the world, and just, like, the kind of... there's like a montage of us going through this fair, and like there's, you know, potentially like the three images of them going through this carnival are them enjoying themselves, but like the way that she's drawn it, it instantly feels like really creepy, really intense. Even though they're potentially, yeah,
it, pretty true. The carousel shot's kind of fish-eyed. Mm. Has the mom's on the horse, and it's really, it makes you, it's unsettling. It's real unsettling. And then that's followed up by that, the roller coaster panel, that's also really unsettling.
Yeah, it's very like uneven and like crazy.
Yeah.
So it's just really kind of cool. And I know that this is on your list as well, isn't it, Riley?
Yeah. So if it helps, this will be my number five too, even though I don't know my order, but it was fucking awesome.
Yeah.
I was really excited about it. The design of the overall design. Are you sorry?
Yeah, no, you go on.
I was getting excited about it as you were talking about it. I liked it so much. So it's probably actually my number one, but I'll talk about it now just because, you know, it makes sense. Do you guys read any Ray Bradbury stuff?
I don't know.
Okay, but he wrote this book called Something Wicked This Way Come, or something, I think that's what it's called. It's about a carnival that comes to a small town in the middle of nowhere, America.
Mm-hmm.
And it totally had that kind of vibe, that the carnival is exciting and mysterious and interesting, but it's super horrific. And it's that vibe, it's one of my favorite books, that vibe totally came through in this. And the art really, really carries it. I mean, Steve Niles is bringing, I mean, I don't know how they broke down the storytelling and everything, but the art really, really carried it in an amazing way.
And what I enjoyed most about, I think, this as a first issue was, like, starting off on, like, a pretty, like, high fucking note, like, I mean, sacrificing this guy, and another guy, like, ripping out of the chest of him, and then him like snapping the girl's neck, and then the rest of the issue you're just like waiting for, like, it's pretty by the book numbers in the way of, like, you know, family goes on a road trip and there's like a weird stop, and then, you know, like, well, this instance the car disappears, but like whatever, car breaks down and they're wandering down the road, and, like, I was just like waiting for like that final page. And the final page is, like, super quiet. Like, they get to, the town, there's no people, and, like, that's it. Like, there's no real, like, horror outside of, like, kind of the imagination of, like, what they're able to create with that. Because even the circus, I mean, it's creepy, but there's nothing, like, if I were at that circus, I wouldn't feel outright, like, something's wrong here. Like, it's just creepy shit. Like, so...
Which is bizarre, kind of, right? Like, nobody's trying to overtly, like, injure them.
Right.
Or anything. It's just bizarre, sort of, and grotesque.
Yeah. I think
it's great,
right,
too.
Like,
and, like...
No, I was going to say, you said it right, that they set it up really well, so that you're already tense, and it's like, it's a classic kind of horror kind of trope, but at the same time, it does work really well. When, you know, you see something horrific and then you get thrown into, like, the mundane, and it's like the mundane, you're looking in the corners all the time. And I think it works really well with Alison Sampson's art as well, because, you know, there's, she's not she's not drawing it as you would see it. She's drawing it as you're feeling it. And like, you know, the bit where they're, you know, they're walking through the carnival, as you say, like every panel is normal and is fine and is them having fun, but you feel tense, and she's kind of leaning into that a lot, which is awesome.
She's amazing, because I interviewed her, I don't know how many years ago now, a few, with her first book, and she did, I don't know, what's the right term? It's not a... who draws buildings? Why am I fucking blanking on that?
Architecture.
Yeah, she did that. Like, that was what she did. Like, mm-hmm. And then she decided to do... I mean, she's always drawn, but like, she worked her way in that way. So she, like, came from that background, and then has kind of, like, taken it into comics, and, like, she's fucking amazing. And, like I said, she's really good at, like... having things be like gritty and ugly, but still be like really great to look at. Because like, I don't know, it's really uneasy, but it's a great issue.
It's real. The other thing that really is attractive to me about it is it's real Sienkiewicz-y.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I just love this. You guys notice too on the first that there's a big first early on in the issue. There's a 2-page spread. There's all these trucks coming to a bonfire. Yeah. There's a subtle little thing in the background that the sort of cloud shapes.
The crocodile maybe thing?
Yeah, there's a crocodile and there's a hippo and like a rattlesnake.
Oh,
or
yeah.
Something.
Oh shit, yeah, I didn't see the... I saw the crocodile, but...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Shit.
Yeah, and I don't know what all that means, but that spread is real, real nice. Real
yeah, it's
nice.
Very cool.
Yeah, and I love that we're... Like, the guy starts to rip out of his chest, and, like, they take the time to have that, like, open panel. It was such a nice break. That was such good. Yeah. It's a fantastic issue. But not on my list. it was on my list, but it was between that and the other one that's, I guess, not similar, but another horror book that I picked over it. But, all right. So, I guess it's back to me. So, technically... Riley's. So my fourth contender is Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 71, which I read a lot of reviews and not people liking it, but I don't really give a shit. But so I figured a Ninja Turtles book would end up on here at some point, because this has been one of my favorite ongoing series, maybe one of my favorite just Turtles comics in the history. I think they do an amazing job of capturing every possible, like, incarnation, you know, TV show, video, like, at this point they've done video games, the movies, they've worked in, a lot of, like, the Tales stuff, every age of Turtles has, like, made its way into this book, but one of the, like, best things they do is, like, they have a huge lore for this run of Turtles, and then they'll take breaks in issues. So this one is just, it's only going to be like a 2-part thing, but it is, it's called like the Pantheon Family Reunion, and it's like, characters that we've seen throughout the series so far, some new ones. They get together like every, I think, 100 years, for like the reunion. It's a group called the Pantheon. It's like an immortal family that, like, is involved with history, but it's all these,
sort of deities, sort of, or something.
Yeah, kind of, yeah, it's kind of hard to tell, like, what they are in the world, but, yeah, you get the sense that, like,
it's real, like, spirited away, like, they're spirit beings of some kind, or
yeah,
something.
And they all have, I mean, there's Rat King, there's Toad Baron, Kitsune, and then, we've seen, Akka, before in the series, but then there's like Jaguar, Man Mammoth, and I think a few others that are old callbacks as well. And for like a Turtles issue, I mean, Turtles don't show up till the very end, but I just thought it was like a really like fun and interesting comic, and I'm all for like taking like a breath and doing like lore building, and this was like a really fun way to do that, to have essentially this family is what they are, more or less, like, get together and have this, like, dinner party and, like, I mean, it's uncomfortable. There's, like, goofy shit with, like, the Toad's, like, servants, like, running jokes with them. And you have, like, the Rat King with, like, the rats everywhere. And then they're there to kind of, like, discuss, like, what they're going, like, what's going on with Shredder and the Turtles and this, like, new part in history. But then you get a lot of inner dynamics with the group. And, again, there's not a, like, lot going on, but I thought just, like, it was so well written as to, like, just this, like, uncomfortable family dinner party, but there are toads and rats and a mammoth, and I don't know. I just had a lot of fun, and it felt, again, like, really good world building that this series has done, so I wanted to call it out in this issue. The art was fantastic. I didn't say the names. It is... where is it? Dave Wesher, and then obviously Kevin Eastman, Bobby Kurnow, and Tom Waltz, on kind of the story. And Turtles has had, like, the best run of artists in comics right now, but, I feel bad, like, two in a row. I don't say, like, they're not groundbreaking issues, but, like, if you're reading Turtles, like, I thought this was, like, a fantastic issue, and... I've seen people complain about it being slow and a lot of dialogue, but I'm all for reading that shit. So, I don't know. That was my take on it.
Yeah, I mean, this is not like... This is not a... It's not an issue to start with, is it? It's not an issue to pick up, because I...
Oh, no.
Like, Turtles, like, is a book that I absolutely, like, really... I read, like, the first couple of arcs of it, and then I kind of dropped off it, and I really want to pick it back up. And like I don't tend to kind of just dive into series. I tend to want to go back and read them again. Like I lost track of Transformers as well. And those are like meant to be awesome. And I really want to kind of get back into those as well. But yeah, I flicked through this one because I thought I don't want to read it because I don't want to spoil too much for myself when I go back. But at the same time, I want to have a look at it and, you know, see why you picked it. And it was not at all what I was expecting from, like a random issue of the Turtles. But I think that's why it works, I think, as well, because, you know, they're doing a lot of, as you say, like a lot of world building, a lot of mythology to it that is way more than you expect and kind of way more than it needs to be as well. And I think they're knocking it out of the park with this. With this kind of series, and like Kevin Eastman, like this is his kind of go around again, isn't it? Really, so he's got this opportunity to kind of build the Turtles up from the start, and this series so far has just been, you know, been awesome. Kind of like this stellar kind of run that, as you say, kind of picks up on all the feelings of every kind of Turtle thing that comes before it. So, like I'm excited to kind of dive back in, and I think this issue and like kind of the fact that we've been covering it has kind of encouraged me to start back from the beginning. So I think I'm going to dive back into Comixology and find out where I've got them all, where I got up to, and just go back through them.
Yeah, and I think like stuff like this is kind of important because they've kind of, so one of the big changes they made with Turtles in this one is that they're reincarnated from their previous life with Splinter, like they're their actual sons, in this series. So they have like a more supernatural element, and that's who, what's her name, Kitsune. She's kind of tied to that. So like to have this again with these kind of, like deities who meet every 100 years for this dinner, kind of like ties into like an aspect of the series they haven't really like hit on in a while because they've been dealing with, you know, normal like foot Shredder stuff. So it was a nice little break, but
I thought it's rad. Like it's a rad series. I'm not like a nostalgia Turtles guy at all. Like I started reading it because Matteo Sanluco is so awesome, and that was, I don't know, the first issue I picked up was whenever he started, so, like, ages ago now, right? Like, issue 30, maybe, or 40?
Yeah.
I don't know, early on. And it just gets better and better, and now I'm reading, like, whenever they do a micro-series, I get those. And,
This is kind of the third part. Like, do you get Turtles? Either of you guys get Turtles Universe?
Yeah, well, because this was in Turtles Universe like 2 issues ago.
The last 2 issues. Yeah, so it's kind of like the third part.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh yeah.
But it was super fun. Like, it's real Miyazaki-ish, and the mythology of the Turtles Universe is really complex and interesting. And they're like incorporating all the just like throwaway toy characters. I think, I don't know if they were ever in comics before. But in interesting ways, like all the mute animals.
Yeah.
I think they're called.
Yep.
Yeah.
I like all that stuff. And also that stuff should be, like, shouldn't be as good as it is. I don't think it's super gimmicky. Like, the toys were super gimmicky that the characters are in the comic, but they're bringing all this, they're building up these characters that I'm not attached to at all. And I love it. I'm excited for it to come out. Mm.
Did you, this is like a side note for Riley, but did you, it's called like a work print edition they put out of Secret History of the Foot.
No, I don't have
so
it.
So it's they have so Secret History of the Foot is the one Santoluco did, like the mini. Yeah. And so like the first half of this hardcover is like on the left page is his pencils and on the right page is like Tom's script. And then at the end of that, they had like an actual story, so you can like go back, look at his pencils, look at the script, and then like flip to like the actual like colored story. It's pretty fucking sweet.
That's awesome. But,
all right, so contender number 4 for Matt, what do you got?
For this, I picked God Country number 6, and this is like the first of 2 issues that I put on my list because it's kind of the end of the series or the end of the run, and so I like the, you know, the issues themselves were awesome, but I just kind of like the idea of just having a like a chat about, you know, what we, if we read the series, what we thought of the series. But this is God Country number 6, which is Donny Cates and Jeff Shore on art, with Jason Wordy and Dee Cunniff on colours, and John J. Hill on letters. And this book, to me, is one of the books of the year. I absolutely like was not expecting to love it. Was not expecting to kind of feel as much as I did for it, and especially wasn't expecting to kind of it get to issue 6 and then it kind of be over. And I don't really know if they've got any plans to continue the universe or start like a series 2 or whatever. But it felt as though it could have, they could have made more of it. Like, I think I did a review of it, and like the only negative I had was that I wanted more, which, you know, is and isn't a negative at the same time. Like, you know, if you want more of something, then that's a compliment, really. But I felt as though they could have taken this concept, this story, which is, you know, of, you know, an old man suffering from, you know, dementia, and he's losing his mind. He, you know, this sword, this god of swords, kind of comes out of nowhere and chooses him as its kind of protect, as its, you know, bearer. And with that, he retains, like, he gets all his memories back, and he becomes like the best version of himself. And then the rest of the series just follows him and his family, you know, coping with this massive change, but also dealing with the gods that you know want to right this seemingly like this seeming wrong, you know, this imbalance in the universe of this old man in Texas with this massive god of swords. And again, like, as a concept, it kind of, I felt like that could just be like saga level epic, and you know, I felt like it was, but they just did it in 6 issues, and this last issue absolutely kind of pays off, you know, everything that they've set up. They've, you know, to their credit, they've kept this story tight. They've kept the focus, like, on, you know, their central kind of plot. They've not had, you know, they've not wasted any page at all in this 6 issues, really. And this is, you know, a massive kind of, as you'd expect from like a series involving gods and, you know, gods and man. It's kind of the ultimate showdown, really. And yeah, it's just really emotionally pays off really well. Like Jeff Shaw's art, he kind of just throws himself into this kind of massive battle, and like he captures both ends of the spectrum, which the book needs. It needs to be this epic, massive kind of gods battling, kind of Walt Simonson level of, you know, kind of epic, but then also, you know, it is at its heart about a man, you know, reconnecting with his family because now he can remember them. And so he kind of captures that as well, like emotional moments. And there's a couple of like real heartbreaking moments in the issue. It just has been like a really stellar series for me. And this issue kind of like capped it off really well. I don't know if you guys read it.
Yeah, it's this final issue. I mean, the whole thing was good, but this really kind of then touching on how a lot of it is just like the allegory for like what you pass on to your family and the memories, and this guy getting this kind of like last chance at those memories, and then when he gives it to his son, his ability to like that's what we get to pass on to like our sons and daughters, and that shit, it was like really great. And Donny Cates, this is like the second book I think he's done. What's the Buzzkill? It's like the superhero who had to get like a drink to get his powers. Like he did an amazing job. I worked doing case management for addicts for a long time, and he wrote probably like the most like realistic look at like what it is to be like addicted and coming off and having family members who are addicts and dealing with that and stuff like that. And then to have this, like you said, this big story with, you know, battling this old god who again has his own issues with his sons, and then the sons having issues with his father, like all just essentially just boiling down to this like tale of this son and father, and them like kind of learning to accept each other, and these memories like all just told under the guise of this like big fucking epic battle with this talking sword. That's fantastic. And Jeff Shaw's I think always a really solid artist. He's great at movement and momentum, and like you said, able to actually kind of get the emotion out of it as well when he needs to in those like quiet scenes.
I think Jeff leveled up on this too. I like his stuff anyways, but I feel like it's not in this particular issue. But in issue 4, maybe? Whenever that all the undead swarm comes to at the house, he really brought his A game, and it was awesome. And I think in the final battle in this issue too, there's some nice illustration going on.
Mm.
I like the whole series a lot too.
Yeah,
and I think really good. Yeah, because he did, he did the one that was like, I could never find the end of this series. It was like a town called Dragon. Was him, and, because after Buzzkill, I tried to find more of him, and he did that, and then I could never find it. So I was glad to see him back, but yeah, I agree. And the coloring on this is outstanding.
Yeah, the colors are, really strong.
Alright, so what are we on for? Contender number 4 for Riley.
I think, you guys want to talk about, we'll say the Batman Elmer Fudd.
Batman Elmer Fudd? Alright. So this is, we'll talk about this now, but this is on all of our list. So we'll let Riley, who himself is drawing Batman right now, we'll let him take it. To start off,
Lee Weeks. I mean, first off, Lee Weeks is just sick. He's so good.
Yeah.
I mean, the creative team just alone is enough. They could do whatever and I'd be happy. I was pretty skeptical about how you make a Batman Elmer Fudd. Like, I didn't know if it was going to be all slapsticky or how Kim was going to approach it. But it was pretty badass. Elmer Fudd as, you know, Hitman. I didn't expect it. And I really, really enjoyed it. I loved it. I loved all the human versions of the Looney Tunes characters. Spoilers. I don't know if the Bugs Bunny character was awesome. I liked everything about it. I didn't expect it to be so gritty and, you know, hardcore, but it was a good crime comic. It was a good Batman comic. It was just a good Batman comic. I loved everything about it. New Weeks is super good.
Oh yeah.
The vibe of it was super weird because I just kept expecting to have more something like slapstick happen, and it was super straight. It's just Elmer Fudd's a hitman. And there was some real dark stuff in there too.
Yeah.
Man.
All of these have been surprisingly, well, I wouldn't say they're all good, but they've been surprised how well they've done these like crossovers. But this one was the best version of the creators. Like, this is like a Tom King. Like, if I was to expect a book by Tom King and Lee Weeks, like, this is what I would expect. And it just so happens they were able to, like, do it under.
And it happens to have Elmer.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And
if they would have just done a Batman story, it would be what you expect. But then there happens to be Elmer Fudd in it.
Yeah, and I mean, it's got a lot of the Tom King hallmarks too. Like, I'm still trying to decide whether I like his Batman or not, but I think he does some of the best like single issues of anything. Like, Batman 23 is still one of my favorite issues I've read this year, and maybe one of my favorite Batman stories. But everything out this was fantastic, and like this it's like one of those, like, by no means should this be good, so to have it be like as solid and on the mark as it is pretty crazy.
Yeah, it's like we were talking before we started recording about us kind of potentially doing like a top 10 of the year, and like, I don't know whether this is going to make the cut or not, but this is certainly going to be one of those issues that I think of when I think about the comics of the year, because it's, you know, I was not expecting it to be on any list at all. And like, to be honest, I've not read any of the other crossovers. I'm gonna now, but based on this one, because I've heard like the Bugs Bunny and Legion of Superheroes is really good as well.
Yeah, that was pretty good.
But this one, you know, I'd kind of judged it and thought, well, Batman, Elmer Fudd, you know, it's not really something that interests me, but that's fine. They're doing it. It's cool. And I like the fact that DC are just doing crossovers with everything at the moment. I think like more of that is awesome. And so like, I thought, this is good. Do that. But, then I started hearing that it's really good, and I started like, I saw a couple of, images from it, and Lee Weeks has just kind of been really stellar with the art, and you know, it is Tom King, and I am really enjoying his Batman run. It's not what I expected from it, and it's not what I thought it was going to be, but I am still really enjoying it. But yeah, this is some kind of like noir shit. It's like bright, like Frank Miller kind of Daredevil kind of style. Like, you know, it's kind of Marv kind of voiceover, and as you say, Riley, like, it could be just a standalone kind of Batman story with any kind of assassin. But the fact that it's Elmer Fudd, and the fact that all the characters in the bar are, you know, are human versions, apart from like, there's one full page spread where Batman and Elmer Fudd like kind of burst back into the bar, and there's a character in the background that's just straight up a mouse. He's just like a mouse in a suit, and it's just like, that's hilarious. And the fact that they've got like, at the end of the issue, they have like a kind of the flip of it, like, this is the gritty DC Batman version of this story, and then they do a Looney Tunes, well, not a Looney Tunes version of the story. Apparently some of them are kind of straight up copies of the story, but this is like the Duck Season episode of Looney Tunes, but just Batman instead. Batman in Daffy Duck's role, which is just, again, really cool. And just generally speaking, if you'd said Batman Elmer Fudd crossover would be in, you know, on top five lists of the month and top 10 books of the year. Like, I would have laughed at you, but I absolutely see that happening.
I didn't even see that mouse till now.
No, yeah, and there's like the very first page has got like a dog walking into the bar, and then I think like there's another page where, like, early on where there's like Elmerfudd walks up to the bar and starts talking to Bugs and says, "Didn't expect to see you here." And like the shadows in the background, one of them is blatantly just Pepe Le Pew, and just actual Pepe Le Pew, like not a human version of him either. And just things like that. It's just like Lee Weeks is clearly having like an absolute blast drawing this. They're just like doing play it as straight as you possibly can, but then also throw a couple of things in there, like throw the Acme stuff in the background of Porky Pig's bar and stuff, and just
that first page is like straight up like late 80s like dark DC comics. Like,
yeah,
it's amazing.
The hero born again or born again or something.
Yeah absolutely, yeah.
Brilliant. Right. So, now I'm already confused. That was Riley's number 4, right?
Yeah, that was it.
Alright, yeah, so alright, so my third contender is a graphic novel by Alexis Zirit, Fabian Rangel Jr., and his wife, Evelyn Rangel. She did the lettering on it. So God bless that woman. So this is the Space Riders team. If you like Space Riders, like, it's pretty much that aesthetic. Like, they're really good at this, like, 70s, like, retro, bright colors. But this one, even more than maybe Space Riders for me, was a lot... I enjoyed this one a lot more because it had a fairly coherent story, but it reminded me so much of, like, Batmanga, where the premise was fairly straightforward, but getting to it was like a lot of fun, and it was essentially like Tarantula kind of busting in on the mayor, and she discovers this like occult going ons. I won't spoil it too much, but since it is like a graphic novel, but so like along the way they just build up this team of like awesome characters who fit perfectly into like Alexis's style, and they do both being like creators of color, like they do, it was really cool to see like the Spanish worked in and it just not be called out like that, like it was just like genuine and in there and like the phrases, and it had that feel of it was something different as I read it, and I don't know. I don't want to give too much away because, like I said, I know we do spoilers, but for something that's a graphic novel, like I feel bad. But it's like all around, like it's a lot of fun. And if you've read either of their stuff, I mean, it's that. It doesn't, I think, break away too much from what they've done, but it has a great feel of those type of books. Like, I keep saying Batmanga, but like anytime I read Batmanga, like it's ridiculous, but getting from like plot A to plot B, they do an awesome job, and there's always just like some silly thing that takes them to that. And then again, just like the character design from Alexis is always amazing. It's like everything I would have like doodled on my like middle school notebook, but 10 times better and colored like a million times better than anything I could do. But I don't know, it's a lot of fun, and like I said, I almost liked it more than Space Riders. The Space Riders is like one of my favorite books, but this was like a lot of fun, and this one felt very much like them, like knowing them and the stuff they continue to put out. Like, this was very much like kind of like a book for them, about them and the stuff they're interested in. Like, it felt very much like a personal project.
This is the only one I didn't read. I didn't get around to reading it this month, but definitely want to pick it up because I love Space Riders. I love the team behind that. Fabian done like some fantastic stuff elsewhere, so I absolutely want to pick this up.
You read this one, right, Riley? Did you say you read this one?
Uh-uh. Same thing, I couldn't get a copy in time.
Oh, damn. Yeah.
I love the creative team.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's that. I mean, I don't, I feel like by the three books I've put on this list so far, I'm like, well, it is what it is. But, just knowing, like, what I like, these books completely fall into it, and it's very much that sense of them not doing anything that they don't need to, and just telling this very basic story, but very much in the sense of, like, this, like, Mexican comic book series, but then also, like I said, having a very, and I know both of them, like, manga-inspired stuff. And it's short. You can read it in one sitting. It's just really good, but...
Yeah, I'm looking,
I don't want to spoil too much about it. It's got a cool ending.
You can get a preview of it, like a PDF preview of it on adhousebooks.com. And looking at it now, it looks awesome. It looks like kind of a, like going for an old kind of grindhouse movie kind of feel to it. I don't know if
that. Yeah, I mean, it's very 70s, and in like, Tarantula, she's very much like a, like Barbarella, like exploitation, type look. And then, I mean, she teams up with Señor Muerte, and he's like a skull mask with like big fucking trench coat and a scarf with a diamond on it. And then they have another guy that comes in, I think his name's Sombra, who is like a Punisher type guy, but he wears like a black hood over him. And they fight villains like along that. Like one's just got like a tight mask on her, but she's got like bat wings. And it's very like occult and, kind of like demon driven, and I mean, nobody draws like skulls better than him. So it was good. So we'll do Matt, your third contender.
Yeah, my third one was again the end of a series. It was the Dregs number 4. So it was like a Black Mask series. Written by Zach Thompson and Lonnie Nadler, and pencils, inks, letters and covers, all of it done by Eric Zawadzki. And this, again, to me, this was one of the books of the year for me. Pretty much, like, the story was really good. The like the concept, which is kind of a modern noir, like, tale about this homeless guy that stumbles upon a mystery that involves the posh restaurants in town, kind of capturing, killing and cooking all the homeless people to try and kind of solve two crises that the city's going through. And it's set in Vancouver, in the future, in kind of like an unspecified dystopian future. And it follows this character, this homeless guy that just lives on the streets and just reads a couple of kind of old beaten up copies of like The Long Goodbye and Raymond Chandler and things like that. And so he views his world like that. He sees his world in a kind of a noir way, as a way of kind of comprehending it, and yet stumbles upon this kind of mystery that is like obviously way more disgusting than anything you'd find in an original noir novel. But at the same time, you know, follows the same tropes and follows the same kind of beats as that kind of story, with the femme fatale, with the kind of the flawed anti-hero and all that kind of stuff. And I'm not a huge noir fan. Like, it's not that I don't like it, I just don't particularly follow it. But really, really dug the vibe of this book, really like appreciated what it was going for. And this issue again feels like it's taken the concept and then kind of ratchets it up to 11. Like, it kind of plays off the idea that all along it's been having these, you know, it's been hitting these tropes and these beats, but then the story kind of resolves itself about halfway through the issue, and then at that point kind of the main character, he kind of loses his mind, you know, when he uncovers the truth. Like, he kind of, the veil slips a little bit, and when he realizes that he can't solve it the way that he wants to, he can't get the ending that he's looking for, his whole world kind of falls apart. And all the way through this series, Eric Zawadzki's art has been amazing. Like, he's experimenting in form and structure and kind of like panel layouts in ways that I can't even kind of comprehend. And this issue, he kind of, you know, knocks it out of the park. You know, he covers everything from kind of intense like kind of conversations between two people. He has like a page where he does like spectacular kind of architecture of the city of Vancouver, and just like, you know, captures like architecture, like realistic architecture, really well. And then on the next page, he just completely starts warping that, like, that architecture, and it twists it as, you know, as the character kind of starts to unravel and his whole world starts to tear apart. And there's like a couple of like full pages where he's, you know, it's kind of Alfred Hitchcock style, like running up steps that don't go anywhere, and like kind of getting that vertigo as you look down at a landscape. And it's just like unbelievable what the guy's been doing in this book. And I feel like the series as a whole definitely deserves like way more kind of credit or way more conversation than I think it's getting. And I think it deserves like to be on kind of lists by the end of the year again. Absolutely. I don't know if you guys have been reading the run or following it, or if you just read it for this, or.
I read them all. I thought it was fantastic. The whole run is really, really good. I really admire how many panels there are per page. It reminds me of Matt Wagner's stuff, except that there's, you know, some of the pages where there's 12 or 16 panels of just, you know, subtle facial expressions changing. I appreciate that, and I appreciate how well the voice of it captures the sort of Ross Campbell, Jim Thompson, like all the 50s and 60s crime writers. I'm really into that stuff, so that just made me happy. And I don't know if you guys noticed or if it was a big deal or not, but I like that they went out of their way to keep it in Canada, and you know, to reiterate over the course of the series that it's in Vancouver, instead of just, they could have like set it anywhere, you know, in any major metropolitan city. I just thought it was cool that it was in Vancouver.
Well, because that's an actual. The dregs are in, they have an area, right, called the Dregs, I'm pretty sure, in Vancouver. I remember I interviewed Eric, I think for the first issue, we were talking about all the grids on those pages and like his his focus and process for the issue and what he was aiming for. But yeah, they made it like a real attempt to. The city itself is like a huge character in the book, and you saw that in like the first like two issues as he was like kind of traversing the city, and like they would have like the map on the page, like him wandering around it. And I mean, as you see like as the issue goes on in this one, like the almost like the city is, I don't want to say alive, but like this to him it is his city, and it's a thing, and he's trying to save it. And
It's very much his city too. I like that about it too. Is that he talks about it? It's like a familiarity that he's losing to the developers, if I remember correctly. It's like slipping away from him. It's kind of neat.
Yeah,
and it's a interesting way to attack and look at like gentrification of these cities. You see, like a lot of, you know, with Portland and Vancouver and San Francisco and stuff like that. And it's like, how do you take care of a population, but also accommodate those coming in, and it's like the idea of, you know, I live in outside of Saratoga, New York, which is like known for like a racetrack, and like during the summer, like it's filled with like rich people coming up to like go to the racetrack. So throughout the year, like it's very much like a lot of like rich people live there. I mean, they live on the outside of it, but that's something as like a caseworker myself, like if you like deal with the town, like is, oh, we don't have a homeless problem. Even though you look on the street, there's homeless people, like just continually like, oh no, we don't have a problem, because you don't want to address it because this thing, because then people know about it. So it was interesting to see that tackled in this, but also like I just love the ending of, I mean, I knew it wasn't going to end, I felt like it was going to end well for him. I was hoping it like kind of did, but to have him defeated and then even then to take him outside, and even more so like this, the conundrum of, yeah, like we are feeding homeless people, granted they're eating other homeless people, but like what do you, like who are you to say like what's right, and then kind of pushing these people to that, and like they have no other choice. And again, just like as a reader, like thinking about that, and that's the point where like it falls apart completely for him. Like I felt that as we went along, like I just like I didn't know how to feel about it, and neither did he. And then I thought that ending was great.
Yeah, and I think like it's good that they did build up the kind of his love of his city and his kind of familiarity with it, and the fact that he'll walk the streets and he gets lost but never is lost because he's home. And then, you know, this issue kind of flips that on its head as well, you know, and it says as much in the narrative, but like you follow the artwork as kind of Eric like, you know, twists the landscape and everything, and until the fact that it is literally kind of fighting against him, like he's squeezing through gaps in buildings that's closing in on him, and he's, you know, he's walking down a pavement that suddenly turns into like a cliff's edge and things like that. So he very much kind of like it kind of personifies, or you know, kind of visualizes his confusion, his feeling that he doesn't even know his own home anymore, and it's kind of been pushed out. And it's awesome. It's really, really well done on all levels, like really well written. And like the art is just kind of spectacular. You can tell again that like he is, yeah, Eric as an artist is kind of, you know, hopefully just getting started, but like this is absolutely, you know, amazing, kind of amazing run that he didn't need to go above and beyond with it, and he absolutely did. It was very well done.
And so we'll be on our third contender for Riley, I think.
Or two Shadows on the Grave.
Shadows on the Grave. This is the Corbin book, yeah. Right?
I love Richard Corbin, and I love Creepy and Eerie, and this is just basically a one-man Creepy and Eerie comic, and they're just all self-contained horror stories, and I think it's just whatever Corbin decides he wants to do, he does. And they're just fun. They're fun, and the production of it too makes me real happy that it's all really, really cheap newsprint, so it feels like a creepier Eerie magazine. And just how he does everything, it could be in that period. Like they could almost be reprints, but they're all new as far as I know. No. The first story is kind of a Dorian Gray, and there's a little bit of a twist to it. And I mean, if you're not familiar with Corbin, he's like, I think he's the king of horror comics. Him and Wrightson are the best, you know. Everything has all this texture, and it feels so rich. It's just always so rich. And just any time I can get a Corbin story, I'm gonna read it.
Yeah, his it almost kind of like we're talking about with oh, I'm already sorry. Ashley Samson? Is that what it was?
Allison.
There's like a fine line between like creepy and unsettling and like ugly and still making it like look good. And I don't know if that like makes sense, but like Corbin's stuff is, for all intents and purposes, ugly, but it's ugly because like it needs to be. And comics and horror are really hard to do, and so if you can pull that off visually to make it unsettling, then like you're already like one step ahead, and like have that on the reader, so when you like draw them in with the story, they're already like unsettled. And his stuff does that amazing. Like you said, the textures are what he's really good at. And I love that. I just love that. I mean, obviously, I mean, his art, I think, is, it's either you like it or you don't.
It's super
like,
polarizing.
There's no, yeah. But I love that Dark Horse just continually just gives him a, like, forum for these. I mean, he, like, is just constantly putting out Dark Horse books. And
it's all kind of the same stuff. It's just, like, short horror books pretty much exclusively, right? And it's cool that somebody's giving him a platform to make it.
Yeah. And he's been doing, like, he's been doing some of the Poe stuff, which was cool, but yeah, this one, issue 4 was the one that came out, and it was like the circus, and then like I love the shot of like the devil walking, or the guy walking down the alley with the devil tail. There's some good twists, like it's what you want from like a short anthology horror type thing, where just that little thing that gets you at the end, like oh, okay, it's like Twilight Zone.
Yeah, that like was short. That's the kind of feeling, isn't it? Like little kind of morality, almost morality tales, except some of them are just kind of like, you know, basically just warning you off the seven deadly sins, aren't they? A lot of the time, it's just like, be careful of greed, or, you know, be careful of vanity and things like that. I really appreciate that kind of stuff. It's an easy series to kind of just pick up a single issue off and just kind of dive in, and you instantly get that kind of feeling. And as Riley said, it could have been made 10, 20, 30, or even like 70 years ago, and it's still as kind of timeless. And there is that kind of element to it, which is really cool.
Yeah, anything else, Riley?
No, I just love Corbin stuff.
Yeah, really, can't really argue that. Alright, so contender number 2 for me, was Batman and Elmer Fudd. So we talked a good amount about that. Like I said, I don't have anything else to add on it, except, like I said, I wouldn't have expected it to be on this list when I made it, because I remember reading Marvin the Martian meets,
Martian Manhunter.
Martian Manhunter, yeah, and that was exactly what I thought it was going to be. So to have Batman Elmer Fudd be good, a little surprising. So let's see. Yeah, Matt's number 2.
My number 2 is Peter Parker, Spectacular Spider-Man. And I'm a massive Spider-Man fan, in kind of all its forms, really. And to get a book like this, which was exactly what I kind of wanted it to be, and like I'm not a huge hater of Dan Slott at all. I really like what he's done with the character, and I really appreciate the fact that he is, you know, every arc he's doing, he's progressing the story and he's developing the character in ways that it's never been done before. He's taking a decades old character and doing new things with it, which has to be admired, like has to be celebrated. However, there's like a feeling of Spider-Man that I feel like is getting lost a little bit, in his new runs. Like I feel like there's not, you know, it's turning into like it could just be a generic superhero. At this point, it doesn't have to necessarily be Spider-Man. Whereas this series, Peter Parker, Spectacular Spider-Man, it's Chip Zdarsky is writing the whole run. There's two stories in this, which we'll cover in a minute, but Adam Kubert is the artist on the main story, with Jordi Belair on colours. It feels like a classic Spider-Man story, but at the same time, he's doing, like, he is still doing new things with it. Zdarsky's not just kind of playing the nostalgia card. He's absolutely got his own voice. He's absolutely trying kind of new New things with the character as well, like there's new kind of interactions, new characters that he's introducing, kind of subtle kind of social complications, like involving kind of villains that are reformed and like kind of a weird kind of awkward flirty exchange that Spider-Man kind of shares with a character that is really fun. You know, there's Chip Zdarsky's got a definite way of writing, you know, and he's kind of very, you know, very irreverent, very funny, really kind of really kind of unique humour to everything he writes. And I feel like he dials that back a little bit with this, but in a way that I feel like he's doing it because he loves the character and he loves the kind of universe. Like there's loads of editor's notes like they used to be in like kind of older superhero comics, and you know, so he's calling back to a lot of things, and so he's covering the fact that Johnny Storm and Peter Parker are really good friends, kind of opens with that, and then, you know, has him interacting with other, like teaming up with other superheroes, which is obviously a big part of Spider-Man's past, but then he's introducing, as I say, like new characters and worlds and things, and it just was really well done. And I think a lot of people will kind of build this book up by knocking Amazing Spider-Man down, and I don't think that's like, I don't see the point of doing that, but I do think that there's a lot in this, there's a lot of fresh kind of energy to this that, you know, someone who's been writing the book like Dan Slott has for, you know, for years at this point, you know, can't maintain over the run, and so, you know, having someone new come in, having someone fresh come in doesn't belittle anything that he's doing, but at the same time, this is kind of there's a fresh energy to it that I think I really appreciated. And this is on your list as well, isn't it, Riley? Did you put this on your list as well, Riley?
Yeah. So this is my number two as well. And I want to talk about the backup story, but the main story too is it. I echo everything that you said about it, is that it feels like Chip really likes Spider-Man. Like it really feels like a sort of love letter to Spider-Man and the character. And he's, you know, is witty, but he's not too silly. And the opener with the Human Torch is real heartwarming. The whole issue is real heartwarming. Like it feels, it's nostalgic. Like I just respond really well to it. Like it feels like when I, you know, was 10 years old reading a Spider-Man comic. It has all those elements in it, but not in a rehashed shitty way. Like in a fresh, exciting way. There's the bit when she goes to the woman that he saves from the guys who are robbing a bank with balaclavas, when she goes to give him the business card. I really like that two panel sequence. Like it's just real charming, you know. Like it's cute. I liked it a lot.
Yeah.
And there's some little throwaway moments too, like when he's helping Ant-Man, and Ant-Man has to be an inch taller, or when the guy makes him an inch taller or whatever. That there's just little bits of it, little bits of humor, and I'm not usually a humor comic fan. Like I don't like silly stuff usually. But it's just on that edge of being comedic but not over the top. And the last page, the cliffhanger is pretty cool too. I like the cliffhanger a lot. So the backup.
Yeah.
The reason I like the backup so much is because anytime Goran Parlov draws something, I just get it. It doesn't matter what it is, I just get it. But it kind of does the same thing, like the way that he handles Spider-Man has the vibe like of, you know, the sort of Ross Andrew era Spider-Man. Just real classic, but real elegant. And there's some Alex Toth kind of techniques. It's awesome. Like, it's just real, really, really competent, good, classic superhero comic art. And it's nice to see that once in a while. And I like Black Widow. And there's little bits of the art. Like, are you guys Goran Parlov fans?
Yeah.
You know, he's done so much Punisher stuff that's so heavy. It's cool to see him do something a little bit lighter.
Absolutely.
And he does this thing, that this rhythmic thing throughout it, that he adds those there's panels just on the white backgrounds, and it's a real cool rhythm that's added to the pages, that every page has one panel with a white background that emphasizes something important. It's cool. It's just really cool classic superhero really cool. storytelling, and the figure work is awesome, and it's fun. The whole issue was super fun. I was surprised how fun it was.
And for him too, like at this point, so I think of a lot of his Punisher stuff, and which doesn't contain a whole lot of like choreographed fights. And so I was like really, I don't want to say surprised, because like he's amazing, but like really good, like fluid, like light movement he got out of like Spider-Man. Like there's the one where she's like just shooting at him, and you can see him like kind of like jump up on his foot, and like it was like so well telegraphed like where he was going, and it was easy to read like where he was at all times. It was like really surprising, because I mean, not surprising again, because like I know you can do it, but it felt like really nice, especially when a lot of times from him recently has just been like Punisher shooting stuff. It was really fantastic.
Is it?
He clicks his heels at one point.
Yeah,
right.
He totally does.
Yeah,
there's a lot of
great
zigzag. Like when you draw a page, you always want to have like a zigzag pattern, and he does really cool things throughout it. Like on there was this page where Spider-Man sort of like limbos under a bullet, and his legs make. He makes kind of an L shape that drops down to him with his hand extended shooting the webs, and the web and his arm makes a diagonal down to the bottom left panel, and then Spider-Man's leg kicks out to the right, and he's really controlling what you look at through the figure's positions on every page. And it's so smooth and elegant, and there's no tricks to it. It's just really, really good comic making.
Yeah, really cool.
And it was weird again. I mean, this is Chip as well, and there's not, I mean, outside of like a little Spider-Man joke in the beginning, like it, I don't want to say it's dark, but it sets something up sinister as to at least what's going on. And like what you guys have said, echoed about kind of the first part, like he has to seem like a huge reverence for this character, because he's pretty refined in the humor, and it's not what I've come to expect from him, which isn't good or bad, like, but it's very refined and very, it fits very much into what I expect from Spidey. Cause I mean, the Ducks, like Howard the Duck stuff, like I don't really know what to expect from Howard the Duck, so he kind of had like free reign with that, but like this, it feels like Spidey, especially with him and Johnny Storm, who like I could read like date night issues with those guys any day of the week. Alright, so that
was... The Spider-Man humor has to be, like, real narrow, because it can't be, like, Deadpool over the top, and it can't be too dry either, right? Like, it's just that sweet spot, and that book just got it. It was real good.
Alright, so now... Well, that was... I'm confused now. Alright, so now... Alright, so it's our number one contenders. So for my number one book of the month is The Unsound from Colin Bunn and Jack T. Cole, lettered by Jim Campbell. It's from Boom Studios. And for me at this point, very few people I think do or understand like horror and comics like Colin Bunn. I think he does a fantastic job of getting the most out of the medium when it comes to horror, but sometimes he does it like better than others. And The Empty Man recently was one of my like all-time favorite like horror comics, and a lot of that was due to Vanessa. But I think I've touched on it a few times in this episode. Like I'll eat up anything with the occult and kind of like otherworldly stuff. Like I just watched The Void the other night. Like that shit was great. But this from the get go, like it just moves, and it's very unsettling. And I mean, like it opens with her neighbor, and like you get a shot into his hoarding house. And as she's walking to work, there's a house like lady with cats, and there's a man on the street, and like it's just. where he's on a subway and it's like someone with like a jar with like livers in a jar. Like, it's just, as you go, it's like, it doesn't stop. Like, it's just consistent unsettling, but it doesn't, at the same time, it doesn't stop to like really like highlight those. Like, you just see it if you want to, and you just keep going. And so it's about this nurse, is it Alicia?
Ashley.
Goes to work in this like hospital type setting, kind of like a mental health institution. So there's a genuine kind of like tropey setup of that, but like I said, from the get-go, it's something's going on. So as she goes in there, she kind of experiences things, and you don't see a whole lot of it, which I always appreciate. Like, there's,
and it's her first day, right?
Yeah, it's her first day.
Like, we're kind of like in real time with her. Like, we're seeing it unfold. She's in a new place, and we're in a new place with her. Like, a real cool point of view.
Yeah, and it's, and her first day, like, it seems to be like they're understaffed. So it's nice because she doesn't seem to get time to like acclimate herself. At the same time, like, as a reader, you don't get to, like, when something happens, like, she hears the voice when she's like putting away her coat, like, that's it. But then someone calls her and she's like back out on the floor, and she meets like a weird patient on the floor who gets like taken away by like these creepy looking men in suits, and then all of a sudden that moves on because she's called to like go do all these other tasks, and she runs into, like, it's just like constantly moving, but like at no point is it like really like drawing anything out. So like, it's just like these like minor moments happening over and over again until like the end, where it just kind of like explodes into this like real fucked up page. And I don't know. I absolutely love it. Like I said, I think he does an amazing job, but I think sometimes he does like, obviously some of them are good, some of them are great. And then like, there's the empty man. And then like, this for me, like, felt like that. Like, I absolutely love this. I read it a few times. Jack T. Cole's art is fantastic. It reminded me a lot of Ian Lurie's on and then the Emily book. Yeah, it reminded me of that, like, very like squiggly proportioned, like, unsettling type stuff. It's a little cleaner than Ian's, but Ian's a lot. But
Ian and Simon Gain had an art baby.
What's that?
Ian Lurie and Simon Gain had an art baby.
Right, yeah. And it's clean when it needs to be, but then it's very, like, dark and scratchy and shadowy. I thought it was, like, fantastic. I actually loved it. I was super excited that he kind of was back at the level I thought with Empty Man. I think it's on, what do you see? It's on your list, right? Ian. It's getting late. Riley, right?
Yeah, it was this in the Winnebago Graveyard were probably the top, my favorite for the month. Also, I really like The Damned. I don't know if you read that, but it was a contender too.
Yeah, that was
good,
too,
I just
right?
didn't want to throw you guys into a number two of The Damned if you're not into it already. So I chose this one instead because I think his creator own stuff is... pretty much all of his horror books I read. Like, I like Harrow County a lot.
Harrow County, just a regression.
Yeah. Regression, yeah.
Yeah.
I like the art on this reminded me a lot of Simon Gain. And that was half the draw. Because I like, shit, what's this book called with Eric Stevenson? They're Not Like Us?
Yeah.
I really like that. I agree with you. I like all the throwaway moments. Or not throwaway moments, but atmosphere building, tension building moments in this, like the cat lady and the hoarder. And just like any of the things that she sees on the way to work are not a big deal by themselves, but taken all together, they make you feel uncomfortable, and like they just set you up to suspect something before she even gets to the asylum, right? And then the razor blade, where she just finds the razor blade on the desk. What? That's just so weird. You're like, what? That's such a weird tone in Asylum. It has a real David Lynch thing going on too throughout it. I feel like there's some moments that kind of get drawn out.
Yeah, that, absolutely. Yeah,
that make you uncomfortable just because they're drawn out. Like when she finds this the dummy that's talking to her, the technical like CPR dummy. That seems kind of like it's a weird. I think it's a weird scene to have at that early in the book, and sort of I don't know, it's just, it's all about setting the tone throughout it. And then,
and I don't know if it was intentional, but like things like, so she's getting on the subway and there's the guy that's like the like typical UR senator. As she's going down, there's an ad for razor blades.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And then she's on the subway, and there's like a see something, say something, and then there's a like, we love our patients, and you will too. Like, there's all these like little things, and I don't know whether they tie or not, but like, there's a lot of just like, you could picture them like if it was a movie, it would be like a quick cut to something like that, and then it would move on to like someone walking or something. Like, it's really extremely well
paced. There's a sign that says that knives and guns and other weapons are strictly prohibited, and then on the next page, she finds a razor blade on the counter.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, okay, I love this.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's like a real kind of quiet pacing to it, isn't there? There's like a almost like watching an old kind of like a 70s horror movie that just kind of slowly builds with like without any music, and then all of a sudden there's like kind of violins or play, like kind of screeching of strings playing as like as the final page kind of turns. I think, yeah, the atmosphere in it is really cool. And I think Colin Bunn's doing, like, he's kind of hitting like, the horror genre from every angle at this point. Or, like, he's kind of trying different things with it. And I really appreciate that in him as a creator. Because he's, like, Harrow County's got a kind of twisted kind of fairy tale vibe to it. And Regression is kind of body horror. And, like, same with The Empty Man. And then this seems to be kind of... yeah, as you said, like a kind of David Lynch kind of slow build, you know, visual, visually kind of uncomfortable, kind of dark horror. And he's like, you know, you get something new from everything he's trying, which is really cool. And as you say, like some of it works better than others, but this one I think was really unsettling and kind of does stay with you, which I really appreciate.
Yeah, and I think that's all of them, because Matt, your number one was...
My number one was Batman Elmer Fudd, which we've covered. Again, like, I think it kind of climbed to the top of my list purely because I just was not expecting to enjoy it as much as I was. So I think that kind of pleasant surprise of it being really good kind of made it stand out enough in my mind to kind of put it to the top of my list. But I think you said earlier... like that it's a tough month. It's a really strong month for comics. So pretty much any of my books could have been number one.
Yeah, and so that, I mean, that's our top five each. And we're gonna.
Here comes a new challenger. What's up, this is Ian from Super Comic Battle Wars. I'm at the laundromat right now just folding some jeans, but my number 3 comic book pick of June 2017 is like whatever fucking issue of Saga came out this month, because that book's always fucking great. Later!
I hated that. We talked about doing this before, and because this month was really tough, and I've probably changed my list at least 6 or 7 times this last week, we're going to do quick honorable mentions, and then we're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll go into the final round. But for me, 2 honorable mentions for the month was Clue Number 1, which I probably should have pulled up, like, creators on it. But I know it's Paula Lore, and, yeah, well, that was bad timing. But Clue Number 1 was another book where I did not expect it to be good at all, and it was a lot of fun. It was like very self-aware. There was really good mystery in it. Like, he does a thing where at the end of the issue there's like 2 extra clues if you keep reading, and the butler like breaks the fourth wall, so he's like talking to the audience and he's like making references to like things you see in conferences or not conference in comics, like as the issue ends, like to be continued. He says like, well, of course it is. Like, we didn't end it. And, but there's an actual like good chemistry between all the characters, and it does set up like a really interesting mystery, that you would kind of expect from Clue. Like, I thought it was, I did not think it was going to be good at all. I like Paul's stuff a lot, so I thought I would give it a try, and I was surprised. And then my other honorable mention is Drifter Number 19, which ends the series. And I just wanted to throw that. It was on my list for a while, but there's a lot of good books. And but the series has been fantastic. It's like as close as you're gonna get to like a mainstream book that I feel like is like Meta Baron's level of like craziness and sci-fi. And it kind of ends on, I think, a fairly high note, a little bit depressing to where the story goes. Definitely not where I thought it was going to go from the beginning, but it's just all around fantastic. I love Nick Klein's work and his coloring. He's like really good at getting like holographic type images. Like he, almost all of his stories, someone has like a holographic hoodie. And they always look fucking awesome. But that series was great. And like I said, his stuff reminds me very much of like Meta Baron's type stuff. What's that line of books? Humanoids. Yeah. Very much that type of style. So it was a great series. But you know, Matt.
I just got a couple. I picked these two because I think I've put them in my top five before, and so I kind of want to vary up my my choices every month. But Rock Candy Mountain number three that came out in June. Carl Starks again is one of my favourite creators. I just think he's got like a real like kind of unique sense of humour. I love his kind of cartooning style, and that continues to be an awesome book. And also like the back matter of each issue is way more involved than it ever needs to be, but it just kind of talks about hobo culture, which there's surprisingly little information about out there. Like, so I think Carl Starks is kind of collating these essays and conversation pieces about hobo subculture and that really kind of, you know, important like socio like cultural kind of aspect of American history, which I find like equally as fascinating. And then Packlist number two, I think that was potentially our number one last month, the first issue, or it definitely made it into the top five anyway. And Dustin Weaver's kind of creator-owned anthology, which is like, you know, if anything, I think I preferred issue two to issue one. I thought it was absolutely amazing. There's like sci-fi space battles. There's like a single page where he does like a space battle in the Amnia Cycle story, and the layout on it is spectacular. Like the way he kind of navigates the page with this kind of choreography of like of ships fighting was kind of blew me away. And so that continues to be a fantastic series. But as I say, I'm trying to kind of vary up my top five, so they made it into my honourable mentions this month, but they may creep back into the top, in a weaker month, especially.
Yeah, second issue was awesome. And Riley, you have some honourable mentions?
Yeah, I had a hard time picking, so I tried to pick stuff that would just be easier for us to all read. Colin Bunn, Brian Hurt book, The Damned. Their stuff together, I think, is so good. They did Sixth Gun, and before Sixth Gun, they actually there's eight issues of The Damned before the current series. It's about sort of mid-level gangster in a world that's inhabited by sort of different factions of demonic creatures, and it's about different people who are dealing with curses. They make deals with these demonic forces, and they get something, but they also get a curse, and it's real, real good. Stray Bullets is always amazing. It always makes you feel super bad in the best way. It's so gross. It's so fucking hardcore. You know, like it's the best crime comic ever made. Or top, you know, at least top five. That and like Hunter Bullets and Brubaker stuff. It's so...
There's a few issues of that where I had to like stop reading and sit. Yeah. Like for a while, I felt really bad about myself.
But then there's these charming little moments too that you know make you smile until you know the other shoe drops, and they usually turn out to be real horrific. And my last one was Extremity, and it's just every issue is super fun. Again, it's super heavy, but it's the story is propulsive, and I just want to read more and more of it. The world building's great. And it has these real high, super fun moments, and then it'll have really dark, weird revenge moments. I recommend it for anybody who's not reading this. It's great.
Yeah, I think that was I think that made it into our top five last month as well, didn't it? Extremity was really cool, really strong run, and again, I think that's one of my top series of the year as well, for sure.
Really, the world building is amazing. You know, just that
yeah, yeah.
From like the spaceship design to creature design, to like all the weird weapons and stuff is really cool. Like there's a shark weapon that one of the characters uses to cut off another character's hand. I think it's a shark that just like bites off people's hands. Like you hold the handle and then it's a shark's mouth on the other side of it. It's really cool.
Yeah, it's crazy. Also, and like the world building and the character design all seems really casual as well. Like it just seems like it's kind of flowing out of him. So it's just kind of like, yeah, this is it. But then it's, before you know it, it's moving on to the next thing. It's really cool.
That, I think in that issue it has the Shiloh, the robot. That's kind of Appleseed inspired, I imagine.
Yeah.
I love that design. Yeah. I love the character and I love the design.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's like one of the most interesting, like, he like had a tutor growing up for art and he's like homeschooled. So he learned to draw with his eyes closed.
Really?
Yeah. So like his instructor would be like, draw a car, like visualize the car. So he would like practice that way. So like he's like super good at, and you can see in his stuff, like we talk about like how things just like flow naturally. Like he's just like really good at like understanding like where things would be and how to get them from like point A to B. It's fucking it's amazing. I always fuck up his name. Who's the guy who draws like the big murals from hand with no can?
Yeah, Dan will totally draw like that. I'm going to ask him about that. We're supposed to play Overwatch tomorrow or tonight. I'm going to ask him about that drawing with his eyes closed thing.
Yeah, he had to draw from like everything in like memory. Like it was really interesting. Like he knew from like being a kid, like he wanted to draw. So like he was like super intense on like getting that shit done.
He draws obviously some kind of cars. He can draw like any vehicle in any position just out of his head. Nuts.
Yeah. So that was our honorable mentions, and like I said, we're going to take a quick commercial break for one of the other podcasts on our network, and then when we come back from that, we will be taking a look at our final round.
Hi, I'm Paul, the host of the Comic Syllabus Podcast, a weekly show on the Multiversity Network of Podcasts. We read widely and we dig deep, bringing different analytical approaches to our study and appreciation of the wide variety of comics out there. Along with comics teachers, critics, and creators, we do close readings of classic and current exemplars of the medium. And we invite you to join us every Tuesday here at MultiversityComics.com. So let's dig deep.
Welcome back, and at this point, we are going to go to the
final round.
Which there'll be a sound effect there, so you won't hear my dumb voice say that. But so in this round, like I said, we're going to take all of our books, which this month maybe be a little, hopefully a little easier because we have a lot of crossover. But we're going to take each of our lists and we're going to try and distill it down into the top five books of June 2017 that you should read, and nothing else was good. Even though I feel bad because I didn't want to put it on the list, even though it's been really good, Batman Shadow, because I felt like it would be like insincere if it was on there. But that's another. Before we go into it, like, it's another book where I was like, all right, we got this book, and then you were drawing it, so I pick up anything you read, not read anything you draw, but it's really fucking good, like.
Yeah, it is really good. It's another one of those like DC crossovers that just really works.
Yeah, and I mean, like I said before, like Riley's one of my top five like favorite artists, maybe even like all I got, ever since like Proof and Cowboy Ninja Vikings, like one of my all time favorite books. Like I treasure that book to no end. And your stuff has been like, there's like Rasputin. There's, like, you, everything before Rasputin, and there's Rasputin, and then there's, like, everything after. It's like this weird, like, and if it's because of Ivan, right?
A lot of it is like, because of Ivan. A lot of it is.
Yeah, but, yeah, it's been fucking phenomenal, but the Shadow stuff is so good. But, so, that is one of the best books of June 2017, but I thought it would be weird if you wanted to talk about it, so I know you don't usually talk about stuff. So, alright, let's see. So, I mean, Batman, go ahead.
I think we're it's between, Winnebago Graveyard, right? And Unsound, and Batman, maybe Spider-Man?
Yeah, well, I mean, so definitely, I mean, Batman has to be on there.
Mm-hmm.
And then, what other doubles do we have? Winnebago, Unsound.
Yeah.
I would have to say, I mean, I think Unsound.
It's pretty fucking good. Right? It's pretty awesome. I'm like,
yeah.
It's between, maybe even just between that and Batman. I mean, Winnebago Graveyard is really good, but I feel like you get a lot of content in Unsound and Batman.
Hmm. Well, that was why I didn't put Winnebago on my list, because I thought the two were not, they're obviously not similar, they're not the same story or anything like that, but out of a horror book, I thought, like, the Unsound did way more. I mean, and it's not to say Winnebago Graveyard won't. I just thought it was, like, a slower first issue. It was a good, it was, like, a fantastic first issue. I'm, like, so excited for more.
Like a half an hour TV show, and then Unsound was, like, an hour or something.
But...
Yeah. Yeah.
But, I mean, we can see what... I'll put Batman and Unsound down there for now.
Okay, I think Spider-Man is really awesome, too, but...
Yeah, I think Spider-Man.
Yeah,
but it's a Spider-Man comic, yeah. And not everybody's into a Spider-Man comic. Like, I think that the Batman, Elmer Fudd, sort of transcends the superhero genre just because it's so, it's just bizarre what it is and how effective it is at being what it is.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. I think it kind of,
and
you don't, like, if you're a fan of Batman or a fan of, like, Elmer Fudd, but you don't need to be a fan of either of those, because it kind of, it tries to be like a noir thing. It tries to have, like, it's kind of has like this 80s kind of as you say, like, kind of born again kind of vibe to it. It's, yeah, there's a lot to unpack with it.
I will say for Spider-Man is, I mean, I've dropped, I was reading like every issue of Spider-Man for the longest time, up until the Doc Ock stuff, which I dropped, and then I've tried numerous times to go back. And then, like, in this, like, the recent relaunch, he, like, owns a company, and he has a lot of money, and all this stuff, so I didn't read that, I didn't really like it, and then, so I read this, and I didn't know where it was gonna fall in, I still don't know where technically this falls, because he seems to be poor, and, in this, but this felt like Peter Parker to me. Which is even weird, because, like, it comes out around the same time as Homecoming, which very much was the same. But this felt more like a Spider-Man story than mainline Spider-Man story. And I was actually excited to read this and be like, oh, okay, this is probably the Spider-Man book that I'm going to be reading.
Mm.
Or, well, that and Miles. I read his Spider-Man book, but...
I think if you're a classic Spider-Man fan, then I think this and Miles' Spider-Man book is pretty much all you need.
Yeah. And, yeah. Alright, so we'll put, we'll move Batman, Unsound, and Peter Parker to the top five for now, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think what.
I mean, I like Winnebago Graveyard, I think, like, because there's, like, obviously, yeah, it's in the same kind of category, broad category as the Unsound, but it does a lot of different things. And again, like, Alison Sampson's art, like, she doesn't do monthly work often. So, like, I think that's worth recognising. But at the same time, I'd be willing to hear arguments for other books as well.
Well, I think, I mean, out of mine, I know, like, I'm willing to take, I know TMNT is not going. I know Shirtless Bear Fighter is not going. And I was the only one that read Tarantula. And I'm not good at making solo cases. but I will say, out of everything on the list that's left, I think we were all pretty positive on the dregs.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I thought that was a pretty solid, like, final issue.
Yeah, it was pretty good.
And I do think, dregs as an OG, or as a trade, is, like, Eisner worthy, you know?
Yeah.
Just,
right.
Yeah, I really hope so.
The only reason I don't think it should get the best issue of the month would be because it's the last issue of the series. Kind of same with God Country, right? Like, I like God Country, you know, as a whole.
Yeah.
But...
Yeah, you know, I wouldn't know whether they're the best examples of the perfect issue of that series, yeah. But, like, the fact that they both come out and they're kind of the end, I thought it'd be good to have a conversation, yeah.
Yeah, and I think... And I like with the dregs... I like that Black Mask puts out those books when those books, like, I don't necessarily know would make, and I've talked to people who put out Black Mask books, and, like, a lot of times those are, like, the last place they've gone and they've taken them, and they're able to tell those stories. Like, I just read Cal Exit, that was out this week,
yeah,
and that was pretty fucking good.
Yeah, I can see us talking about that next episode.
I mean, he was able to have, like, the, like, last, like, 8 pages of that book is, like, him just doing interviews with people he finds interesting in, like, the, like, non-profit, like, activist scene and shit like that. That was really great. So that was cool to see that. The dregs, I enjoy. Because I know they shopped that around, and that was the last place they got it. Let's see. So, I mean, because even, I'd say out of the dregs and God Country, I would put dregs on there. Before God Country.
Yeah, I like God Country, but I think I thought that was a good issue, but I think there were better issues in the run, like arguably like the first or even second issue maybe were probably better. Yeah, so I can lift that off just so that it makes our choices a little easier.
Alright, so the top 5 right now, we have, and this isn't in the order, but with Batman, The Unsound, Peter Parker, and the Dregs. So we got one more spot here.
I think Winnebago Graveyard was pretty awesome.
Yeah, I don't think we can argue against the. Yeah, I mean, everything that's left, and like I said, I thought it was a really unique first issue because it started off with the gore and then it didn't go back to it, which I really liked.
And I think, like, the only other one on our list is Shadows on the Grave. And I think, like, the gift of that series is you could pick up any issue and, like, it could be, you know, they're as good as each other, aren't they? And they're kind of standalone series, which is quite cool. Whereas I don't know whether Winnebago Graveyard is going to get better or worse or what, but, like, as a first issue, a debut issue of, like, an ongoing narrative, I thought it was really strong.
Yeah, I mean, I want to argue for Shadows on the Grave, but because everything is always the same, I mean, this particular issue isn't necessarily the one you need to get either. For first issue, the Winnebago Graveyard was really awesome.
I
want to argue against Shadows on the Grave. I mean, it's awesome. If you like Corbin, it's it's awesome.
Yeah.
You know?
It is awesome.
But I mean,
yeah,
the selling
really
point
good.
Is that Corbin's the best at horror, end of story. That's the selling feature, right? And the throwback nature of it, if you like classic horror comics.
Yeah. I mean, and I think that would be where, if we were, like, the pro is it's Corbin and, like, it's the best person doing the best thing that he does, but it's more of that. Like, I mean, every issue of Shadows is great because of that, and then, like, every of the one shots he's done out before that. So then, like, Winnebago being the first issue, and I felt like it did something different that I necessarily haven't seen, but is it as good as, like, a person doing a great issue of a continually great thing? That's always, like, the tough part. Like, like would I ever, I mean, I'm not caught up on it, but like would I ever put Saga on this list? I don't know, because like it's always it's like consistently great to the point where like I'm unimpressed by it, which sounds weird, but
because well, it's harder to dazzle someone like when the expectation is so high, right? Like same with Stray Bullets,
right?
Like I think Lapham's art is awesome, his storytelling is awesome, his 8-panel grid is really unique way to tell a story every issue in. Like, every issue, he does the same grids, and it's awesome. But I've read it for, you know, however many issues now, that I only notice if... I had only noticed if it was worse, because it's the best already. It's like, it's a 10 out of a 10 at... I don't know. It's not that I'm bored of it. I love it every time. But I know what you mean.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'll leave it up to... Our guest, Shadows or Winnebago, Graveyard, or we can just put Batman in the Shadow. What about that?
I put the Winnebago on because it's so we don't get very much of Allison Sampson's art, so it's really like it's a treat. So as much as I love Corbin, I mean they're both horror books, and it's exciting to see something like this. Just those carnival panels make me so happy.
Yeah, I love that little dude. You know the
front of the House of Horrors or whatever, that's the cat's head. It makes me like anxious how good that is. Like as like an artist, and I'm like, fuck, why didn't I think about that? And it's just so cool. And same with the carousel too. The carousel makes me so happy, and it makes me just a little bit jealous because it's so good.
Alright, so now we gotta order. Let's see. Alright, so we have Batman, Unsound, Peter Parker, Dregs, and Winnebago, Graveyard.
I think the Batman issue, just because of how surprising and how the craft is so good. Like, the craftsmanship of the whole thing is just so good. I think that kind of has to be the number one. Everyone was surprised, and it was pretty much perfect, right?
Yeah, and the second I read it, I knew... Like, I remember reading it and thinking, like, because we do the show, I was like, well, this is probably number one.
Yeah. And I think the fact that all three of us picked it, like, has to mean something as well.
Yeah.
You know those issues that, the Pax Americana issue that Morrison and Quitely did? It's cool. Quality. Like, that issue, I would like a hardcover of just the issue. And I feel like I would like a hardcover of just this Batman Elmer Fudd. Like, I like it that much.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I want an hour documentary on that Pax, like making that issue. And I've read it so many times.
Have you read it backwards? Because it works.
Because you can read it backwards and it makes sense. Like, it's fucking insane. Like, that's like, that is like the pinnacle of like what you can do with the medium of comics. It's insane. And then there's Batman Elmer Fudd. Like, it's crazy.
Have you read that backwards?
I haven't. I don't know how that would. It might work.
Probably wouldn't work.
Alright, so number one, we got Batman.
And then I think that we all kind of agree that Unsound was pretty awesome, right?
I think I'm happy Unsound went too.
I love it. It didn't hit me at first, but like when you first see what's his name? They give him a name. The John Doe guy. And he's spinning the plate.
Yeah.
And his eyes show up, and I didn't realize, like, oh fuck, they're in the wrong place.
Yeah.
That's why it's like Lynchy, like, or like David Cronenberg or something.
Yeah. And like, that's like shit, like, pulling off like horror in comics is hard. So like, being able to like work in moments that you might see in a movie were great. That's why like I always thought like Nailbiter was amazing, because they were like super good at like having those movie moments, like, in a comic, like, POV stuff, or, like, flashes, like, the lights would go out and it would come back on, like, shit was that, and Nailbiter was always so great. Alright, so Unsound, number one. Alright, so Peter Parker, Dregs, and Winnebago, Graveyard. I don't know if we would change. I think Peter Parker... Is that better than Dregs? I think it's a better issue than Dregs. I don't know if it'll be a better series.
Dregs is really awesome, but again, because it's the fourth issue, and it's like, I want people to pick it up, and I want to bring attention to it, but I don't think that that particular issue, I think the second issue is probably my favorite of them.
Mm. Yeah, I'd agree with that, actually.
Yeah. Even the first issue with that, like, full-page circle.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I think
yeah,
the second...
And then the first and the second one had more of, like, the sort of altered state panels, right? It's been a while since I read
that. Yeah.
Yeah, had
yeah,
like
even the first one,
the drug use and kind of using like that kind of change people's faces, kind of like almost like Francis Bacon kind of portrait pictures of their faces.
And like really cool stuff with the palette, differences like the colors. The colors are so like washed out most of the time, but when they're in altered states, I think if I remember,
yeah,
them,
really
they're
cool.
Real bright and sparkly.
I think all maybe right, maybe so then... put Winnebago Graveyard up one. So I have dregs at the bottom.
Yeah.
Put it in the dregs of the list.
Yeah.
Ooh.
It's a fucking dead joke.
Put Peter Parker in there for like comfort food at number four.
Oh, you want Peter Parker at four?
Yeah, yeah.
So you think it should be Batman, Unsound, Winnebago, Parker, dregs?
That sounds good.
If Peter Parker, if next month Peter Parker is this good, I think it'll like it would climb the list. I think we need to see where it goes. Cause I hate with like lots of superhero stuff, you know, you start with number one and you get a couple good issues and then it's just hard to say what's going to happen. You know, it's hard to say if it's going to stay at that high of a quality. I have to change it.
All right. So for our final top five definitive best comics ever of June 2017. Number five is The Dregs, number four, finishing out that series. Number four is Peter Parker, The Spectacular Spider-Man, number one, main story and its backup. Number three is Winnebago Graveyard, number one. Number two is The Unsound, number one. And top book for June 2017, Batman and Alfred Budd crossover. Who would have guessed? Guess that. So, I mean, that wraps up our portion of our top, our battle, our war. Taking a break till next month. We'll start with Riley because he is our creator guest. We talked about Batman and Shadow going on. Number three just came out, right? So what else is going on?
Mostly just drawing Batman Shadow. Lots of fights and stuff.
And
I've been trying to push compositions and figurative work and try new stuff on that book. Like, as you read it, I don't know if you guys have noticed yet, but by the time you get to issue six, I've been trying to do just like a lot cleaner contours, stronger, cleaner contours, and then less little hatching lines on the inside of shapes.
Yeah.
Cool.
I've noticed too, you have a lot more like full body shots than I'm used to seeing.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know what else to do with superhero books, especially when there's lots of figures on the page, and there's complex actions happening. I feel like I have to keep the camera pulled out a lot, and it's harder to find opportunities to do more close-ups and stuff. But I've been studying Duncan Fegredo's stuff a lot lately.
Right.
And he does a thing that I didn't notice I was doing it for a little while until a friend pointed it out, that he has characters' feet in panels a lot. And I've been trying to make an effort to have more people with their feet on the ground plane. And I think it's harder to draw than just torsos, like from the waist up or cropping in on stuff. And,
I think it gives them like more of a presence, because I was thinking of, I think it's issue three where you see, is it that one? I don't know. You see one where like Shadow is in like a ready stance, and you see like a full shot of him, and you get like a real like perspective of his like body mass and like where he is in it, which you don't get kind of a lot of times when you're like pulling away, and you only get like torso shots.
Yeah.
And you draw like, you have the little bat ears.
Yeah. Which, you know what? Did you get Kelly Jones Batman, but I don't know how to deal with that. Like, I don't know how to deal with those long Batman ears.
Those long, yeah. Those feel like it'd be really hard, especially perspective wise, but. I love the little bat ears. So where can anyone find your stuff, or you?
Just comic shops, you know, local places, like, or regular places, Comixology. But, you know, I'd always prefer you go to your local comic store if you can help it. Amazon. And Twitter, I guess, a little bit.
Yeah, and if you haven't, anytime I have a podcast, I try and get right on. But if you haven't read Cowboy Ninja Viking or Green Wake or Debris or, I don't know, any, I don't think I've read a bad Riley book. But, yeah. How's the fatherhood going?
It's pretty intense. It's good.
Yeah, it's the fucking worst. It's honestly the best thing I've ever done in my life, and I hate every fucking minute of it, but I love, like...
That's the best, but you just don't have, it's like you don't have free will, you know? Like, well, I go do no, this, and, but, the baby's crying, so I'm not going to.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I have a 3.5-year-old and a 2-year-old, so this is like two things that can instantly die at any moment.
Yeah.
And they just like fight with each other, and I hate everything. But
we draw a lot together, which is kind of awesome. Like awesome. Year and a half later, but we have a like paper all over our living room, like on the floor. We tape down big pieces of butcher paper, and like my wife went to art school, so she can draw a little bit. And we draw stuff for Rosa, and she colors it or scribbles on it or paints on it.
So that's awesome.
Like that together.
Yeah, it's amazing. Like what they see when they draw. He's been drawing like pirate ships.
Oh, awesome.
And yeah, it's pretty fun, sweet. Matt, where can we find you? What are you doing?
I'm mostly just writing reviews for Multiversity Comics. You can find me on there. I did the review for Calexit number 1 this week, and it's pretty awesome. I do another podcast called That's the Issue. Where you can find us on Twitter at That's the Issue, or search for That's the Issue Comic Book Podcast. You can find us on iTunes and all that, where we have people on, guests on, where we discuss, pick an issue, a comic book issue that they love, that was kind of formative for them or significant to them in some way, and get to know them a little bit through the issue. But at the moment, we're kind of just... Me and Wes decided to cover Secret Empire and all of its tie-ins as kind of a bit of a side project, and that's kind of overwhelmed and taken over the show at the moment. But you know, if you dig that kind of thing, then you can check us out there. And I'm on Twitter at Matt Loon, MATTLUNE.
You know, we're doing 2 commercials this episode, Matt.
Yep, right. Snuck that one in there.
I have listened to the Secret Empire stuff because I don't understand that event. But, yeah, and then I'm on Twitter at Kyle Overkill. I'm one of the staff interviewers at MultiversityComics.com, which we're obviously on the podcast network there. I should have an interview going up with Victor Santos this week or next week for his new... noir samurai graphic novel, which I'm pretty fucking excited about. And what else do I do? Oh, I do that stupid Master Paint Theater on there where I take covers from the week and I redraw them in paint, and that's a thing I do.
And you're better at it than you should be.
Yeah, well, that's what it's getting depressing. Like, I'm actually getting like fairly decent at using paint, which is like a skill that translates to nothing.
It's like getting really good at Guitar Hero.
Yeah, exactly. And then like thinking you're good at it, so you go pick up a guitar and you're terrible, so like I just go pick up a like paintbrush and I'm fucking awful. So that's this episode of Super Comic Battle Wars. We will be back, I guess we're still on the 3rd Friday of every month, which is a weird date, but that's... We don't pick it. And I don't think, probably shouldn't say that. So.
I was going to say, airing our dirty laundry.
I'll note to cut that. But again, thanks for listening. And a huge thanks to Riley for coming on, taking a break from
thinking
Batman to talk about comics.
Cool, that's awesome.
Alright, yeah, and that's this issue of Super Comic Battle Wars Volume Number 1, Part 2, the Vegeta Saga. Tune in next month.
Bye. All right.
See ya.
Alright, thanks, Matt. Thanks.